Chapter 4.
He was not Mr. Wentworth, the former curate of Monkford, however suspicious appearances may be, but to Captain Frederick Wentworth, his brother,
who, being made commander in consequence of the action off St. Domingo, and not immediately employed, had come into Somersetshire in the summer of 1806.
And having no parent living, found a home for half a year at Monkford. He was, at that time, a remarkably fine young man, with a great deal of intelligence, spirit, and brilliancy, and Anne, an extremely pretty girl, with gentleness, modesty, taste, and feeling. Half the sum of attraction on either side might have been enough, for he had nothing to do, and she had hardly anybody to love. But the encounter of such lavish recommendations could not fail. They were gradually acquainted, and when acquainted, rapidly and deeply in love. It would be difficult to say which had seen the highest perfection in the other, or which had been the happiest, she in receiving his declarations and proposals, or he in having them accepted. A short period of exquisite felicity followed, and but a short one. Troubles soon arose.
Sir Walter, on being applied to, without actually withholding his consent or saying it should never be, gave it all the negative of great astonishment, great coldness, great silence, and professed resolution of doing nothing for his daughter. He thought it a very degrading alliance, and Lady Russell, though with more tempered and pardonable pride, received it as a most unfortunate one.
Anne Elliot, with all her claims of birth and beauty and mind, to throw herself away at 19, involve herself at 19 in an engagement with a young man who had nothing but himself to recommend him, and no hopes of attaining affluence but in the chances of a most uncertain profession, and no connections to secure even his farther rise in the profession, would be, indeed, a throwing away, which she grieved to think of. Anne Elliot, so young, known to so few, to be snatched off by a stranger without alliance or fortune, or rather sunk by him into a state of most wearing, anxious, youth-killing dependence. It must not be, if by any fair interference of friendship, any representations from one who had almost a mother's love and mother's rights, it would be prevented.
Captain Wentworth had no fortune, had been lucky in his profession, but spending freely what had come freely,
had realized nothing. But he was confident that he should soon be rich, full of life and ardour. He knew that he should soon have a ship and soon be on a station that would lead to everything he wanted. He had always been lucky. He knew he should be so still.
Such confidence, powerful in its own warmth and bewitching in the wit which often expressed it, must have been enough for Anne.
But Lady Russell saw it very differently. His sanguine temper and fearlessness of mind operated very differently on her.
She saw in it but an aggravation of the evil.
It only added a dangerous character to himself.
He was brilliant. He was headstrong. Lady Russell had little taste for wit, and anything approaching to imprudence a horror. She deprecated the connection in every light.
Such opposition as these feelings produced was more than Anne could combat. Young and gentle as she was, it might yet have been possible to withstand her father's ill will, though unsoftened by one kind word or look on the part of her sister.
But Lady Russell, whom she had always loved and relied on, could not, with such steadiness of opinion and such tenderness of manner, be continually advising her in vain.
She was persuaded to believe the engagement a wrong thing, indiscreet, improper, hardly capable of success, and not deserving it. But it was not merely a selfish caution under which she acted, putting an end to it. Had she not imagined herself consulting his good, even more than her own, she could hardly have given him up. The belief of being prudent and self-denying principally for his advantage, was her chief consolation under the misery of parting, a final parting.
And every consolation was required, for she had to encounter all the additional pain of opinions on his side, totally unconvinced and unbending, and of his feeling himself ill-used by so forced a relinquishment. He had left the country in consequence.
A few months had seen the beginning and the end of their acquaintance, but not with a few months ended Anne's share of suffering from it.
Her attachment and regrets had, for a long time, clouded every enjoyment of youth,
and an early loss of bloom and spirits had been their lasting effect. More than 7 years were gone since this little history of sorrowful interest had reached its close, and time had softened down much, perhaps nearly all, of peculiar attachment to him. But she had been too dependent on time alone. No aid had been given in change of place, except in one visit to Bath soon after the rupture, or in any novelty or enlargement of society. No one had ever come within the Kalinch circle who could bear a comparison with Frederick Wentworth as he stood in her memory. No second attachment, the only thoroughly natural, happy and sufficient cure at her time of life, had been possible to the nice tone of her mind, the fastidiousness of her taste in the small limits of the society around them. She had been solicited, when about 22, to change her name by the young man who not long afterwards found a more willing mind in her younger sister. And Lady Russell had lamented her refusal, for Charles Musgrove was the eldest son of a man whose landed property and general importance were second in that country only to Sir Walter's, and of good character and appearance. And however Lady Russell might have asked yet for something more while Anne was 19, she would have rejoiced to see her at 22 so respectably removed from the partialities and injustice of her father's house
and settled so permanently near herself. But in this case, Anne had left nothing for advice to do. And though Lady Russell, as satisfied as ever with her own discretion, never wished the past undone,
she began now to have the anxiety which borders on hopelessness for Anne's being tempted by some man of talents and independence to enter a state for which she held her to be peculiarly fitted by her warm affections and domestic habits. They knew not each other's opinion, either its constancy or its change on the one leading point of Anne's conduct, for the subject was never alluded to. But Anne at 27 thought very differently from what she had been made to think at 19. She did not blame Lady Russell. She did not blame herself for having been guided by her. But she felt that were any young person in similar circumstances to apply to her for counsel, they would never receive any such certain immediate wretchedness, such uncertain future good. She was persuaded that under every disadvantage of disapprobation at home, and every anxiety attending his profession, all the probable fears, delays and disappointments, she should yet have been a happier woman in maintaining the engagement than she had been in the sacrifice of it. And this, she fully believed, had the usual share, had even more than the usual share, of all such solicitudes and suspense been theirs, without reference to the actual results of the case, which, as it happened, would have bestowed earlier prosperity than could be reasonably calculated on. All his sanguine expectations, all his confidence had been justified. His genius and ardour seemed to foresee and to command his prosperous path. He had, very soon after their engagement ceased, got employ, and all that he had told her would follow had taken place. He had distinguished himself, and early gained the other step in rank, and must now, by successive captures, have made a handsome fortune. She had only navy lists and newspapers for her authority, but she could not doubt his being rich, and, in favour of his constancy, she had no reason to believe him married. How eloquent could Anne Elliot have been? How eloquent, at least, were her wishes on the side of early warm attachment and a cheerful confidence in futurity against that over-anxious caution which seems to insult exertion and distrust providence. She had been forced into prudence in her youth. She learned romance as she grew older, the natural sequel of an unnatural beginning. With all these circumstances, recollections and feelings, she could not hear that Captain Wentworth's sister was likely to live at Kellynch without a revival of former pain, and many a stroll and many a sigh were necessary to dispel the agitation of the idea.
She often told herself it was folly,
before she could harden her nerves sufficiently to feel the continual discussion of the Crofts and their business no evil.
She was assisted, however, by that perfect indifference and apparent unconsciousness among the only three of her own friends in the secret of the past, which seemed almost to deny any recollection of it. She could do justice to the superiority of Lady Russell's motives in this, over those of her father and Elizabeth.
She could honour all the better feelings of her calmness.
But the general air of oblivion among them was highly important from whatever it sprung. And in the event of Admiral Croft's really taking Kellynch Hall, she rejoiced anew over the conviction which had always been most grateful to her,
of the past being known to those three only among her connections by whom no syllable, she believed, would ever be whispered,
and in the trust that among his,
the brother only with whom he had been residing had received any information of their short-lived engagement. That brother had been long removed from the country, and being a sensible man and, moreover, a single man at the time, she had a fond dependence on no human creatures having ever heard it from him. The sister, Mrs. Croft, had then been out of England, accompanying her husband on a foreign station, and her own sister Mary had been at school while it all occurred, and never admitted by the pride of some and the delicacy of others, to the smallest knowledge of it afterwards. With these supports, she hoped that the acquaintance between herself and the Crofts, which, with Lady Russell still resident in Kellynch and Mary fixed only 3 miles off, must be anticipated, need not involve any particular awkwardness.
Chapter 5. On the morning appointed for Admiral and Mrs. Croft's seeing Kellynch Hall, Anne found it most natural to take her almost daily walk to Lady Russell's and keep out of the way till all was over, when she found it most natural to be sorry that she had missed the opportunity of seeing them. This meeting of the two parties proved highly satisfactory and decided the whole business at once. Each lady was previously well disposed for an agreement and saw nothing, therefore, but good manners in the other. And with regard to the gentleman, there was such an hearty good humour and such an open, trusting liberality on the Admiral's side as could not but influence Sir Walter, who had besides been flattered into his very best and most polished behaviour by Mr. Shepherd's assurances of being known by report to the Admiral as a model of good breeding. The house and grounds and furniture were approved. The Crofts were approved. Terms, time, everything and everybody was right. And Mr. Shepherd's clerks were set to work without there being a single preliminary difference to modify of all that this indenture showeth. Sir Walter, without hesitation, declared the Admiral to be the best-looking sailor he had ever met with, and went so far as to say that if his own man might have had the arranging of his hair, he should not be ashamed of being seen with him anywhere. And the Admiral, with sympathetic cordiality, observed to his wife as they drove back through the park,
"I thought we should soon come to a deal, my dear, in spite of what they told us at Taunton. I mean, the baronet would never set the Thames on fire, but there seems to be no harm in him."
Reciprocal compliments, which would have been esteemed about equal. The Crofts were to have possession at Michaelmas, and as Sir Walter proposed removing to Bath in the course of the preceding month, there was no time to be lost in making every dependent arrangement. Lady Russell, convinced that Anne would not be allowed to be of any use or any importance in the choice of the house which they were going to secure, was very unwilling to have her hurried away so soon, and wanted to make it possible for her to stay behind till she might convey her to Bath herself after Christmas. But having engagements of her own which must take her from Kellynch for several weeks, she was unable to give the full invitation she wished, and Anne, though dreading the possible heats of September in all the white glare of Bath, and grieving to forego all the influence so sweet and so sad of the autumnal months in the country, did not think that, everything considered, she wished to remain. It would be most right and most wise, and therefore must involve least suffering to go with the others. Something occurred, however, to give her a different duty. Mary, often a little unwell and always thinking a great deal of her own complaints and always in the habit of claiming Anne when anything was the matter, was indisposed, and foreseeing that she should not have a day's health all the autumn, entreated, or rather required her, for it was hardly entreaty, to come to Uppercross Cottage and bear her company as long as she should want it instead of going to Bath.
"I cannot possibly do without Anne,"
was Mary's reasoning, and Elizabeth's reply was,
"Then I'm sure Anne had better stay, for nobody will want her in Bath."
To be claimed as good, though in an improper style, is at least better than being rejected as no good at all. And Anne, glad to be thought of some use, glad to have anything marked out as duty, and certainly not sorry to have the scene of it in the country, and her own dear country, readily agreed to stay. This invitation of Mary's removed all Lady Russell's difficulties, and it was consequently soon settled that Anne should not go to Bath till Lady Russell took her, and that all the intervening time should be divided between Uppercross Cottage and Kellynch Lodge. So far, all was perfectly right, but Lady Russell was almost startled by the wrong of one part of the Kellynch Hall plan when it burst on her, which was Mrs. Clay's being engaged to go to Bath with Sir Walter and Elizabeth as a most important and valuable assistant to the latter in all the business before her. Lady Russell was extremely sorry that such a measure should have been resorted to at all, wondered, grieved and feared, and the affront it contained to Anne and Mrs. Clay's being so much use, while Anne could be of none, was a very sore aggravation. Anne herself was become hardened to such affronts, but she felt the imprudence of the arrangement quite as keenly as Lady Russell. With a great deal of quiet observation and a knowledge, which she often wished less, of her father's character, she was sensible that results the most serious to his family from the intimacy were more than possible. She did not imagine that her father had at present an idea of the kind. Mrs. Clay had freckles and a projecting tooth and a clumsy wrist, which he was continually making severe remarks upon in her absence, but she was young, and certainly altogether well-looking and possessed in an acute mind and assiduous pleasing manners, infinitely more dangerous attractions than any merely personal might have been. Anne was so impressed by the degree of their danger that she could not excuse herself from trying to make it perceptible to her sister. She had little hopes of success, but Elizabeth, who, in the event of such a reverse, would be so much more to be pitied than herself, should never, she thought, have reason to reproach her for giving no warning. She spoke and seemed only to offend. Elizabeth could not conceive how such an absurd suspicion should occur to her, and indignantly answered, for each party's perfectly knowing their situation,
"Mrs. Clay never forgets who she is, and as I am rather better acquainted with her sentiments than you can be, I can assure you that upon the subject of marriage they are particularly nice, and that she reprobates all inequality of condition and rank more strongly than most people. And as to my father, I really should not have thought that he, who has kept himself single so long for our sakes, need be suspected now. If Mrs. Clay were a very beautiful woman, I grant you, it might be wrong to have her so much with me. Not that anything in the world, I am sure, would induce my father to make a degrading match, so that he might be rendered unhappy. But poor Mrs. Clay, who, with all her merits, can never have been reckoned tolerably pretty. I really think poor Mrs. Clay may be staying here in perfect safety. One would imagine you had never heard my father speak of her personal misfortunes, though I know you must 50 times. That tooth of hers, and those freckles. Ugh, freckles do not disgust me so very much as they do him. I have known a face not materially disfigured by a few, but he abominates them. You must have heard him notice Mrs. Clay's freckles.
There is hardly any personal defect which an agreeable manner might not gradually reconcile one
to. I think very differently. An agreeable manner may set off handsome features, but can never alter plain ones. However, at any rate, as I have a great deal more at stake on this point than anybody else can have, I think it rather unnecessary in you to be advising me.
Anne had done. Glad it was over and not absolutely hopeless of doing good. Elizabeth, though resenting the suspicion, might yet be made observant by it. The last office of the four carriage horses was to draw Sir Walter, Miss Elliot, and Mrs. Clay to Bath. The party drove off in very good spirits. Sir Walter prepared with condescending bows for all the afflicted tenantry and cottagers who might have had a hint to show themselves, and Anne walked up at the same time in a sort of desolate tranquillity to the lodge where she was to spend the first week. Her friend was not in better spirits than herself. Lady Russell felt this breakup of the family exceedingly. The respectability was as dear to her as her own, and a daily intercourse had become precious by habit. It was painful to look upon the deserted grounds, and still worse to anticipate the new hands they were to fall into, and to escape the solitariness and the melancholy of so altered a village, and be out of the way when Admiral and Mrs. Croft first arrived. She had determined to make her own absence from home begin when she must give up Anne. Accordingly, their removal was made together, and Anne was set down at Uppercross Cottage in the first stage of Lady Russell's journey. Uppercross was a moderate-sized village, which, a few years back, had been completely in the old English style, containing only two houses superior in appearance to those of the yeomen and labourers, the mansion of the squire, with its high walls, great gates and old trees, substantial and unmodernised, and the compact, tight parsonage enclosed in its own neat garden, with a vine and a pear tree trained round its casements. But upon the marriage of the young squire, it had received the improvement of a farmhouse elevated into a cottage for his residence, and the Uppercross Cottage, with its veranda, French windows and other prettiness, was quite as likely to catch the traveller's eye as the more consistent and considerable aspect and premises of the great house about a quarter of a mile farther on. Here Anne had often been staying. She knew the ways of Uppercross as well as those of Kellynch. The two families were so continually meeting, so much in the habit of running in and out of each other's house at all hours, that it was rather a surprise for her to find Mary alone. But being alone, her being unwell and out of spirits, was almost a matter of course. Though better endowed than her elder sister, Mary had not Anne's understanding nor temper. While well and happy and properly attended to, she had great good humour and excellent spirits, but any indisposition sunk her completely. She had no resources for solitude, and inheriting a considerable share of the Elliot's self-importance, was prone to add to every other distress that of fancying herself neglected and ill-used. In person, she was inferior to both sisters, and had, even in her bloom, only reached the dignity of being a fine girl. She was now lying on the faded sofa of the pretty little drawing room, the once elegant furniture of which had been gradually growing shabby under the influence of 4 summers and 2 children, and on Anne's appearing, greeted her with,
"So you have come at last. I began to think I should never see you. I am so ill I could hardly speak. I have not seen a creature the whole morning."
"I am sorry to find you unwell. You sent me such a good account of yourself on Thursday."
"Yes, I made the best of it. I always do. But I was very far from well at the time. And I do not think I ever was so ill in my life as I have been all this morning. Very unfit to be left alone, I am sure. Suppose I were to be seized of a sudden in some dreadful way and not able to ring the bell. So, Lady Russell would not get out. I do not think she has been in this house 3 times this summer."
Anne said what was proper and inquired after her husband.
"Oh, Charles is out shooting. I have not seen him since 7 o'clock. He would go, though I told him how ill I was. He said he should not stay out long, but he has never come back, and now it is almost 1. I assure you, I have not seen a soul this whole long morning."
"You have had your little boys with you?"
"Yes, as long as I could bear their noise, but they are so unmanageable that they do me more harm than good. Little Charles does not mind a word I say, and Walter is growing quite as bad."
"Well, you will soon be better now. You know I always cure you when I come. How are your neighbours at the Great House?"
"I can give you no account of them. I've not seen one of them today, except Mr. Musgrove, who just stopped and spoke through the window, but without getting off his horse. And though I told him how ill I was, not one of them have been near me. It did not happen to suit the Miss Musgroves, I suppose. And they never put themselves out of their way."
"You will see them yet. Perhaps before the morning is gone. It is early."
"I never want them, I assure you. They talk and laugh a great deal too much for me. Oh, Anne, I'm so very unwell. It was quite unkind of you not to come on Thursday."
"My dear Mary, recollect what a comfortable account you sent me of yourself. You wrote in the cheerfulest manner and said you were perfectly well and in no hurry for me. And that being the case, you must be aware that my wish would be to remain with Lady Russell to the last. And besides what I felt on her account, I really have been so busy. I've had so much to do that I could not very conveniently have left Kellynch sooner."
"Dear me, what can you possibly have to do?"
"A great many things, I assure you. More than I can recollect in a moment, but I can tell you some. I have been making a duplicate of the catalogue of my father's books and pictures. I have been several times in the garden with Mackenzie, trying to understand and make him understand which of Elizabeth's plants are for Lady Russell. I have had all my own little concerns to arrange, books and music to divide, and all my trunks to repack from not having understood in time what was intended as to the wagons. And one thing I have had to do, Mary, of a more trying nature, going to almost every house in the parish as a sort of take leave. I was told that they wished it, but all these things took up a great deal of time."
"Oh. Well, but you never asked me one word about our dinner at the Pools yesterday."
"Did you go then? I have made no inquiries because I concluded you must have been obliged to give up the party."
"Oh, yes, I went. I was very well yesterday. Nothing at all the matter with me till this morning. It would have been strange if I had not gone."
"I am very glad you were well enough. And I hope you had a pleasant party."
"Nothing remarkable. One always knows beforehand what dinner will be and who will be there, and it is so very uncomfortable not having a carriage of one's own. Mr. and Mrs. Musgrove took me, and we were so crowded. They are both so very large and take up so much room. And Mr. Musgrove always sits forward. So there was I, crowded into the back seat with Henrietta and Louise, and I think it very likely that my illness today may be owing to it.
A little further perseverance in patience and forced cheerfulness on Anne's side produced nearly a cure on Mary's. She could soon sit upright on the sofa and began to hope she might be able to leave it by dinner time. Then, forgetting to think of it, she was at the other end of the room beautifying a nosegay. Then she ate her cold meat, and then she was well enough to propose a little walk. When they were ready, Mary said,
"Where shall we go? I suppose you would not like to call at the great house before they have been to see you."
"I have not the smallest objection on that account. I should never think of standing on such ceremony with people I know so well as the Mrs. and Miss Musgrove."
"Oh, but they ought to call on you as soon as possible. They ought to feel what is due to you as my sister. However, we may as well go and sit with them a little while. And when we have that over, we can enjoy our walk."
Anne had always thought such a style of intercourse highly imprudent, but she had ceased to endeavour to check it from believing that, though there were on each side continual subjects of offence, neither family could now do without it. To the great house, accordingly, they went to sit the full half hour in the old-fashioned square parlour with a small carpet and shining floor, to which the present daughters of the house were gradually giving the proper air of confusion by a grand pianoforte and a harp, flower stands, and little tables placed in every direction. Oh, could the originals of the portraits against the wainscot, could the gentlemen in brown velvet and the ladies in blue satin have seen what was going on, have been conscious of such an overthrow of all order and neatness, the portraits themselves seemed to be staring in astonishment.
The Musgroves, like their houses, were in a state of alteration, perhaps of improvement. The father and mother were in the old English style, and the young people in the new. Mr. and Mrs. Musgrove were a very good sort of people, friendly and hospitable, not much educated, and not at all elegant. The children had more modern minds and manners. There was a numerous family, but the only two grown up, excepting Charles, were Henrietta and Louisa, young ladies of 19 and 20, who had brought from school at Exeter all the usual stock of accomplishments and were now, like thousands of other young ladies, living to be fashionable, happy, and merry. Their dress had every advantage, their faces were rather pretty, their spirits extremely good, their manner unembarrassed and pleasant.
They were of consequence at home and favourites abroad. Anne always contemplated them as some of the happiest creatures of her acquaintance, but still, saved as we all are by some comfortable feeling of superiority from wishing for the possibility of exchange, she would not have given up her own more elegant and cultivated mind for all their enjoyments, and envied them nothing but that seemingly perfect good understanding and agreement together, that good-humoured mutual affection, of which she had known so little herself with either of her sisters. They were received with great cordiality. Nothing seemed amiss on the side of the great house family, which was generally, as Anne very well knew, the least to blame. The half hour was chatted away pleasantly enough, and she was not at all surprised, at the end of it, to have their walking party joined by both the Miss Musgroves at Mary's particular invitation.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Ballarat National Theatre's adaptation of Jane Austen's Persuasion and will join us each week until all the episodes have been released. This production is directed and narrated by Liana Emerson, with Sarah Barlow as Assistant Director for Sound Design and Composition. This episode features the voices of Alex Roberts as Anne Elliott, Nicholas Barker-Pendry as Sir Walter, Jodie Mattingly as Mrs. Clay, Fred Preston as Mr. Shepherd, and Brianna Gere as Mary Musgrove, previously Elliot. As in, she was previously Mary Elliott, like as in it's her sister. You guys understand. I don't know why I'm explaining it to you. This podcast features original compositions within the chapters, like musical ones, which were written by Sarah Barlow, Liana Emerson, and Helen Gibson, and were mastered by Charlie Hughes. This podcast was produced by Ballarat National Theatre on the lands of the traditional custodians, the Wathaurong people. Further sound production and cast recordings were made in the lands of the Wathaurong, Wurundjeri, Woi Wurrung and Boon Wurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation, and the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Ballarat National Theatre acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional custodians and to their leaders, past and present. This podcast was made possible because of the financial contributions of the following patrons: Aparajita Rachaudhry, Josh Illichman, Elaine So, Tessa Braun, Sean Rundell, Brianna Cook, Shelley Barnes, Seanchan Nguyen, Sue Skews, Sarah McGregor, Lynn Gibbs, and Rod Skews. Thank you from the director for supporting access to technology that allowed this podcast to be made. This podcast was possible because of collaborative support for recording and music performance from Ballarat Grammar Academy Sound and Performance. It is also supported by grant funding from the City of Ballarat. Now, if we have any bloopers, you'll hear them now.
If we hear noises now, we are being joined by a cat.
I think it very... No, I don't.
Oh, gosh. Excellent opening.
Then I'm sure Anne had better stay, for nobody will want her in Bath. I quite like the little giggle, actually. It's like, she's so shit.
And I think it's very likely that... That was a bit Australian. Likely.
She often told herself it was folly.
But you have never asked me one word.